One of my favorite authors is a fellow named Steven Pinker. And Pinker's written a few very interesting popular books, one of which has the rather grandiose title, How the Mind Works. And Pinker starts off his book by explaining why, in fact, he's not going to talk about how the mind works, or he's certainly not going to give a complete answer. So I've a similar sort of act of hubris today. I'm giving a pedagogical talk which claims to be an overview of quantum information science. In order that you don't all demand your money back, I thought I'd perhaps start off with a similar disclaimer. I'm of course only going to concentrate on a very small part of quantum information science, which reflects my particular interests, but I think nonetheless reflects much of the wider interest in the community, basically by giving some simple examples of work in quantum information science. There's an interesting challenge here in that it's going to be a pedagogical talk, which means that I'm not going to assume much background amongst audience members, or at least I'm going to aim to reach people who don't know a heck of a lot about quantum information science. On the other hand, we've got some of the world's leading experts on quantum information science here, and I don't want to have those people fall asleep. So what I'm going to try and offer those people is mainly not new technical results, because the technical results I'll be describing are very simple, but rather perhaps a slightly unusual perspective on quantum information science as a whole, which I feel encapsulates much of the recent progress that has been made, but perhaps hasn't been made fully explicit before. Now, most of you have probably seen introductions to quantum information science before, most likely concentrating on a technological application like superfast quantum computers or interesting technological applications like quantum teleportation. I'm not going to focus on things like that today, or at least not on the technological side. Instead, I want to focus on quantum information science as a science. In particular, rather than focusing on technology, I'm going to focus on the fundamental questions which quantum information science hopes to address, talk about some of the principles it uses to address those questions, and to explain some of the progress that has been made towards answering those questions. I want to start off with the general question, what is quantum information science? And to answer this question, I'd like each of you to imagine that you're a chess grandmaster, like, for example, Garry Kasparov here, and you're introduced to a character who claims to know all about chess. Well, you play a game against this person, and you quickly discover that, in fact, well, literally, they've told you the truth, because they always make moves in accordance with the rules. Unfortunately, they make absolutely insane moves. They sacrifice their queen for no apparent gain at all, their rook for a pawn. It's just nuts. What you conclude is that while they know the rules of chess, they don't really understand the game of chess. And in a similar way, even though humanity as a whole has known the rules of quantum mechanics for the last 80 years, it doesn't necessarily mean that we understand quantum mechanics. And by this I mean something rather different from what people usually mean when they make claims like this. Rather than, you know, having some problem with measurement or whatever, what I want to say is that in chess, you know, we've got these high-level principles which constitute a true understanding of the game, and which our friend Homer Simpson doesn't have, but Garry Kasparov does. And that's what we mean when we say that we understand a theory or a particular situation, whether it be chess or quantum mechanics. My claim is that there are high-level principles implicit in quantum mechanics, but not actually explicit in the rules, and our task, well, one of our tasks as humanity as a whole, if we want to claim that we really understand quantum mechanics, is to discover what those principles are, to make those principles explicit. And one way of viewing quantum information science is as the attempt to discover what those high-level principles are. Now, what I, of course, would like to do is first of all, you know, give you some idea of what these high-level principles, mythical high-level principles are, and I'll do that by going to a completely different field. I want to quote from Robert Laughlin's 1998 Nobel Prize lecture for his explanation of the fractional quantum Hall effect. Laughlin makes a rather remarkable statement. He says, "I give my class of extremely bright graduate students who have mastered quantum mechanics but are otherwise unsuspecting and innocent a take-home exam in which they're asked to deduce superfluidity from first principles. There is no doubt a special place in hell being reserved for me at this very moment for this mean trick, for the task is impossible." And the way he justifies this incredible claim is to say that superfluidity, like the fractional quantum Hall effect, is an emergent phenomenon, a low-energy collective effect of huge numbers of particles that cannot be deduced from the microscopic equations of motion in a rigorous way, and that disappears completely when the system is taken apart, a viewpoint that he attributes to a 1972 paper by Anderson. Moore is different. Okay, I'm not necessarily going to say that I agree with Laughlin. What I think everybody can agree on is that in systems like the two-dimensional electron gases and superfluids, we can have remarkable quantum phenomena that are governed by sort of high-level principles, the principles governing the fractional quantum Hall effect or superfluids, which are not at all evident or not at all easy to deduce from the underlying principles of quantum mechanics. Yes?
How do you feel about that? Would you agree that you can perfectly drop quantum mechanics and put classical mechanics?
Indeed. Absolutely, absolutely. Yep. I'm just mainly interested in, of course, the quantum scenario. I'm talking about quantum information science. Okay, so I'm kind of trying to establish that such phenomena at least exist in quantum mechanics. And so one approach to it, of course, is that taken by condensed matter physics, or you can also, people in quantum optics study similar phenomena and in other fields. The sort of point of view that I want to take today about quantum information science is that it offers a technique, a methodology for studying complex quantum systems. And obviously it's rather different than the techniques which are used in, for example, condensed matter physics. It uses techniques which are originally inspired by information theory, and thus the name, quantum information science. But just looking at much of the recent literature, for example, over the last year or so, one is struck by the fact that many of the papers on quantum information science actually have nothing to do with information theory. Instead, they seem to have made use of some sort of principles abstracted from information theory to study or to try and understand some of the high-level principles implicit in quantum mechanics, basically for the purpose of understanding collective quantum systems. So quantum information science then has departed somewhat from its origins in classical information theory, and I'm going to try and explain what some of the principles are which have been abstracted away from those origins later on in the talk. Why should this work? Well, classically, information theory, one way you can cast it, is that it studies properties of collective systems, collections of bits, which are independent of physical representation in some sense. So it doesn't matter, you know, how you're given your bit. It doesn't matter whether you're given a bit in the form of you know, some voltage differential, or it could perhaps be the state of some mechanical system. There are properties satisfied by collections of bits which are independent of their physical representation. And much of the work in quantum information science is aimed at understanding properties of systems independent of physical representation. I'll give you a very concrete example very shortly. Another way in which quantum information science differs from other areas of work is that it's on very general properties of quantum systems. Rather than focusing on specific systems like a two-dimensional electron gas, it focuses on very general systems. Just finally, I think one of the things that we've learnt from quantum information science over the last 10 years, or 20 years, is that complex quantum systems can exhibit much richer behaviour than complex classical systems. And for that reason, I'm going to be willing to call even systems of a few quantum particles complex, in the sense that they can really show quite remarkable behaviour. Okay, let me actually give an example of quantum information science in action. I want to talk about the modern understanding of entanglement. And all of you, of course, would have heard about entanglement in your undergraduate quantum mechanics classes. But what you may not realize is that there's been a real explosion of work over about the last 5 or 6 years aimed at understanding entanglement in a new sort of way. And what I want to do is to explain the series of insights which has led to this explosion of work. Obviously, something happened to cause this sudden interest. Let me just go back and explain what entanglement involves. It involves two or more parties. I'll just use the labels Alice and Bob for convenience. And each of those parties has some system, physical system, in their possession, and it's prepared in some state. And this is a canonical example of an entangled state. So we've got two spin one-half systems, and you've got a superposition of the up, up, and down, down state. And of course, it's not possible to write this as a product of a state of Alice's system alone and of Bob's system alone. And this is rather remarkable from a classical perspective. Of course, if you know exactly the joint state of a classical system belonging to Alice and Bob, then surely you know what state Alice's system is in and what state Bob's system is in. But in quantum mechanics, that's not the case, because it's impossible to obtain such a factorization. And Schrödinger, in 1935, made the claim that he would not call entanglement one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. Well, that's all very well to make that claim. Can we make it a little bit more precise? And of course, this was done somewhat more recently by Bell and Aspe, who showed that entanglement can be used to show that no locally realistic, i.e. essentially classical, theory of the world is possible. So Bell proposed basically an experiment which could be used to test whether or not local realism was correct, and showed that in fact, no, it's not. So that's a major advance over Schrödinger. Rather than having a vague statement, it was now precise. Entanglement is somehow essentially different from the classical phenomena. A next major advance occurred in the late 80s and early 1990s, when people realized that not only could you use entanglement to show that there's something essentially different about quantum mechanics than classical physics, but in fact you could use it to do interesting things. So for example, Arthur Eckert in 1992 showed that you can do cryptography using entanglement, that is, distribute information without the danger of being overheard by an eavesdropper. Bennett and Wiesner showed that entanglement could be used to transmit classical information more efficiently than you might naively expect, something called superdense coding. And then a whole bunch of people, a team of six people, showed that you can teleport a quantum state from one location to another without actually needing a quantum communications channel. And since that time, there have been quite a few, or many, many more, applications of entanglement where you can do something that would be either difficult or impossible classically. And a few of those applications are really quite incredibly interesting. I guess two that come to mind are so-called quantum secrets sharing schemes and quantum error correction. And then there's a bunch of other arguably less interesting applications as well. So the moral, I think, to take away from this is that entanglement is a useful physical resource that can be used to accomplish tasks that would otherwise be difficult or impossible. And that's something we've really only realized in the last 10 or 15 years. And you can actually cast this in a slightly more imperative form. If you're in some situation and want to achieve some goal, you can always ask yourself the question, what would I gain by throwing some entanglement into the problem? Actually, I happen to know that in the case of quantum teleportation, that's almost exactly what happened. Apparently, there's a big discussion going on between various people, and one of the people involved said, what would happen if we maybe threw a Bell pair into the mix? And they discovered teleportation shortly thereafter. So that's almost a sort of a direct historical quote there. Okay, so that's where we were in about the early 1990s. Still, that doesn't explain sort of the recent explosion of interest. I guess I'd like to actually give an example. Contrary to my earlier claim, I am in fact going to talk about teleportation, but I'm not going to be really focusing on the sort of the technological aspects. Let me just give a brief explanation of how teleportation works. I want to come back and use it to illustrate some ideas of quantum information science later on. So the idea is that Alice has in her possession some system. It might be, well, imagine it's a single spin one-half particle. And she wants to transmit that system, the state of that system, over to Bob. And one way of doing that would be if she had a quantum communications channel in her possession. Unfortunately, imagine that she doesn't have it. Is it possible to transmit the state of the system over? Well, things don't really look too good if she doesn't have such a channel. After all, I mean, imagine how you might do that. One way you could imagine doing it would be for Alice to perform a measurement on her system. One way you could imagine Alice trying to accomplish it would be to perform a measurement on her system, send the information over to Bob, the classical information now. She might have a classical communications channel. And then for Bob to attempt to reconstruct the state. Unfortunately, of course, we know that it's not possible to non-invasively or to determine the state of an unknown quantum system. What's more, even if that were possible, describing the state of even a single spin 1/2 particle actually requires an infinite amount of classical information. So she'd have to do a heck of a lot of classical communication in order to accomplish the task. So things are not looking especially good. However, quantum teleportation provides a way of, in fact, achieving this task even when a quantum communications channel is not available. The way it works is as following. There's some third party off maybe in some other location, it doesn't really matter too much. And that third party has two spin 1/2 particles in their position, in their possession. And they cause some interaction to occur between the particles, which entangle it in our Bell state, which I mentioned before, and then send the two particles off to Alice and Bob, respectively. The next step of the teleportation protocol involves Alice introducing another system into the problem. And what she uses this system to do is to perform a measurement on her two systems, on her two spin 1/2 particles. So she does some interaction with the two systems, which cause, of course, the state of the particles to be destroyed. Now, let's try and get some intuition for what would go on over on Bob's system. We know, of course, that if you do a measurement on just that particle alone, or most of you will probably have heard before that if you were just to measure 1/2 of an entangled pair, that would cause some sort of a change over on Bob's half of the entangled pair. Now, what is done in the teleportation protocol is a very clever joint measurement of these two systems, and what happens again is that Bob's the state of Bob's system changes, but in fact it changes in such a in a way that depends on what the initial state of Alice's system was. This is just it's sort of a remarkable algebraic fact. I don't know of any better way of explaining it other than to go through and do the mathematics. It's just a few lines, but as far as I'm aware, nobody's come up with a better explanation other than it works. So what happens is they do this measurement, which causes the state of Bob's system to change in some way that depends upon the initial state of Alice's system, the one that she wants to teleport. And Alice then uses a classical communications channel, which is much easier to develop than a quantum information channel, to send the result of her measurement, two bits in this particular case, over to Bob. And it turns out that Bob can then do some operation, which depends, the actual operation depends upon the measurement result, and recover the original state. And that's how quantum teleportation works. Of course, left out a few of the technical details, but that's the basic sequence of operations. And if Alice had received some other measurement result, then the operation that Bob performed would have been different, but no matter what the measurement result is, at the end of the day, Bob ends up with the correct quantum state. Okay, so that's quantum teleportation in a nutshell. So that's an example of using entanglement to do stuff. I want to talk about sort of my last two points, really, about entanglement. I think two things that were really only realized in the early 1990s, or mid-1990s. And these two facts I call representation independence and qualitative equivalence of entangled states. So to explain what I mean, I want to use an analogy to energy. So imagine you're given energy in some form, for example, chemical energy inside a battery. Well, we know that, in fact, the energy inside that battery is, in some sense, equivalent to the energy, nuclear energy, obtainable inside the sun. It's representation independent, in some sense, or it satisfies properties which don't depend upon the particular form in which you're given that energy. For example, well, the laws of thermodynamics are the classic example. In a similar way, entanglement has properties that are independent of physical representation. What I mean by that is that, for example, if we wanted to do quantum teleportation, it doesn't matter whether we're given the entanglement in the form of two spin 1/2 particles, two photon polarizations. It really doesn't matter. You can do entanglement. You can do quantum teleportation no matter what form you're given that entanglement. And for that reason, instead of using the spin 1/2 notation, which I've been using, I'm going to switch to the notation of qubits. I'm going to use the 0 for the up state and the 1 for the down state and so on. A friend of mine who's a laser physicist likes to complain that quantum information people are always talking about qubits this, qubits that, rather than talking about actual physical systems. That actually seems to me to be a very important point. What they're talking about is properties of systems which are independent of the physical representation which they're using. You don't necessarily need to talk specifically about atoms or photons or whatever. There are these systems satisfy properties independent of their physical representation. The other point is that is this qualitative equivalence. So imagine that you're given one very large battery, or perhaps a collection of perhaps a small battery. The energy contained in those two systems is nonetheless basically of the same kind, in the sense that if I was to have a whole bunch of these little batteries, I could do exactly the same sorts of tasks as if I had the large battery. So different types of energy, different amounts of energy, are qualitatively equivalent to one another. They're of essentially the same kind. And one of the things that's been realized in the study of entangled states is that different entangled states are actually qualitatively equivalent in a very similar sense. You can talk about having a particular entangled state and comparing it to some other entangled state, and those two states actually have essentially the same property, in the sense that anything you can do with one, you could do with the other, given enough copies of that state. And I'll actually explain exactly what that means later. One of the things that this observation about energy, this interchangeability, motivates us to do is to try and develop a quantitative theory of energy, to say how much energy is there in a particular physical system, in the sun or in a large battery or in a small battery. And in a similar way, we're going to try and develop a quantitative theory of entanglement. So let me just summarize what I've said, these four basic observations: that entanglement is not classical, it's a resource that can be used to do interesting things, entanglement has properties which are independent of physical representation, and different entangled states are qualitatively equivalent to one another. So these four things, I think, were all well understood basically by about 1995, and that was when people asked whether or not it might be possible to develop a quantitative theory of entanglement. And I'll explain how that theory is developed in just a few minutes. Before I do that, I want to make one final remark on why you'd want to do that, just driving home this analogy with energy a little bit more. You can think of the collection of sort of all possible physical systems. So think of each dot, each pixel up here on the screen as some different physical system. That's a very complicated space. Now, there's an easier way of understanding it, the space, is to introduce various sorts of labelings on that space. So one way of labeling physical systems is by their energy. And I'll just make an analogy here with colour. So you can think of all, say, the yellow states as having the same amount of energy. And there are other ways of labelings as well. You can talk about the amount of information content of a physical system. You can talk about the amount of entanglement in a physical system. And you've got these different equivalence classes of physical systems. Each one of these systems here, if this is labeled by energy, has the same properties with respect to transformations that only change the, or whose basic significance involves the manipulation of energy. And in a similar way, it's going to turn out that there are transformations which only really essentially affect the entanglement. So by using these labelings, you can get interesting information about what sorts of transformations are possible. So the idea is that, certainly in the case of entanglement, we're going to try and introduce and develop a good theory of such labels, which will enable us to simplify the description of complex phenomena. That's the motivation for introducing this quantitative theory of entanglement. So how exactly should we do that? How should we say how much entanglement is present in a quantum state? Well, I'm going to do it by sort of an exact analogy to how we determine how massive a particular physical system is. It's very, very simple. Imagine we want to determine the mass of some particular physical object. Well, the first thing we need to do is to develop some kind of a standard mass. It doesn't really matter what that standard mass is. I'm going to imagine it's a ball bearing. And the way we determine the mass is to try and balance one way of determining the mass is to try and balance our object against a large number of copies of our standard mass. The standard mass should be easily reproducible. That's the main requirement. Unfortunately, of course, usually the mass of our object isn't an exact multiple of the mass of our standard mass. But there's an easy way of getting around that problem, and that's to consider large numbers of copies of each. And by taking an appropriate ratio of the number of standard masses required to balance a certain number of copies of our object, in the limit where you've got a large number of copies of both, you can come up with a sensible definition of the number of standard masses present in a particular copy of the object. So we can define a measure of entanglement in a similar way. The very first thing we need to do is to define a standard unit of entanglement. In the case of mass, it of course does not matter what we choose as our standard unit of mass. We can in principle use anything at all, the proton or the banana. It really doesn't matter. So I'm going to assume that it's not going to matter a whole heck of a lot, just as a working assumption, and I'm going to choose this Bell state. Notice I've switched to the 0-1 notation here in preference to the up-down notation. So this is going to be my standard unit against which I'm going to try and measure entanglement. So what I want to do is balance a large number of copies of my Bell state, beta tensored up m times, with a large number of copies of the object whose entanglement I'm trying to determine. How should I define balance, such a balancing operation? Well, in order to define what I mean by balance, one way of doing it, then the entanglement, by analogy with the mass, would just be the limit, as m and n both become large, of this ratio of the number of copies of our standard unit that are required to balance a certain number of copies of the state whose entanglement we're trying to measure. Okay. How should I define this notion of balance? Well, one way I can do it is to define a notion of balance would be if I could define a notion of what it means for one state to be at least as entangled as another. So two states would then be balanced if they each was at least as entangled as the other one. So such a notion actually is pretty easy to define. What we do is we say, imagine that we start with some particular, Alice and Bob start with some particular entangled state, no longer necessarily a Bell state, could be anything. And, well, let's imagine that they do something to this state. So, for example, Alice might do some local operations on her system, maybe she performs some measurements on it, and Bob could also do the same thing on his system. And then they do some communication, maybe they do some communication, some classical communication backwards and forwards. Well, intuitively, at least, none of these operations involve the generation of entanglement between Alice and Bob's system. So at the end of the day, the final state which they have shouldn't be any more entangled than the one that they start with, because none of these operations involve the generation of entanglement. That's the motivation. I'm not necessarily going to claim it's perfect, but we'll, this is the one we're going to run with. So the idea then is that we say that a state phi is more entangled than some other state eta if, starting with phi, we have such a protocol involving just classical communication and local operations, which gives at the end of the day that state eta. That's our definition for what it means for phi to be more entangled than eta. Well, that's the definition which we're going to use or try to use to develop this notion of balance of entanglement. And if we use this notion, then what it means for m copies of beta to be balanced by n copies of psi would simply be that when we take m copies of beta, do these sort of local operations and classical communication, we should be able to come up with n, we should be able to produce n copies of psi, and vice versa. So that implies that this state is at least as entangled as this one, and we should also be able to do the reverse process. Robin?
When you say local operations, that includes non-unitary?
Yep. You can do whatever you like. Yeah. Just provided it doesn't involve some sort of quantum interaction between Alice and Bob that could be used to generate entanglement. Okay? Okay. So this would seem to be a very natural notion of balancing entanglement, or provide a very natural way of defining such a notion. There's a problem, however, of course. M and N are going to be finite for any particular values of M and N. So maybe this state here is a little bit more entangled than that state there. Or maybe that state there is a little bit more entangled than that state there. If this one's a little bit more entangled, then this reverse process won't be possible. There's an easy way around this slight technical problem, though, and the way of getting around the problem is basically to introduce a small parameter, epsilon, a little bit larger than zero. So for, what we require is that for any epsilon greater than zero and sufficiently large M and M, it should be possible to take M copies of our Bell state to N copies of psi. And conversely, it should be possible to take N copies of psi to almost M copies of beta, M times 1 minus epsilon. And if we do this, or make this definition, then we can define the entanglement as the limit, as M and M become large and epsilon goes to zero, of this ratio of M over N. And that's the way in which we define the measure of entanglement. I should mention, actually, that I've swept one issue slightly under the rug. It turns out not to be possible to make these transformations exactly, but you can make them as good as you like. You can make them to an arbitrary level of approximation. That's a slight technical side point, not too important for us. Okay, so that's our definition of entanglement. Great, we've got a definition. Unfortunately, that's no good if we can't actually calculate with it, or it wouldn't be a whole lot of good. Ah, excuse me. I want to just make some comments about how you can think about this measure then. If we rearrange slightly here, you see that what it means is that basically n copies of psi can be reversibly converted, roughly speaking, up to these epsilons, into n times the entanglement in psi, Bell state. So you can go from one to the other. You've got this reversible interchange, which is possible. And having this point of view is actually sort of, that's the right way of thinking about it. What it tells you is that a single copy of psi, from the point of view of entanglement, contains the amount of, it's equivalent to E of psi Bell states, where E of psi is this entanglement measure, which I've defined up here. Okay, what this point of view down here lets you see very easily is that, in fact, this entanglement measure, E of psi, is the maximal number of Bell states that can be obtained per copy of psi by local operations and classical communication. How can we see that it's actually maximal? Well, imagine it weren't maximal. Imagine that we could get more copies, more Bell states from a single per copy of psi. If we could do that, then we could go from n times E of psi Bell states over into n copies of the state psi, just by definition of the entanglement measure. And then, because it wasn't maximal, we'd be able to go back over here and we'd have more Bell states than we started with, because we could convert a single copy of psi into more than E of psi Bell states. So we'd be able to go from n times E of psi Bell states into more than n times E of psi Bell states. And I'm just going to claim for you, and it can actually be shown rigorously, that by local operations and classical communication alone, it's not possible to increase the number of Bell states that you've got. So that's the way you see it's the maximal number of Bell states that can be obtained per copy of psi. That's an important fact, which we'll need later. So how do we actually calculate? Well, we've got a state psi, Alice and Bob. You can define a reduced density matrix for Alice's system by tracing out Bob's part of the system, and similarly you can define a reduced density matrix for Bob. And it turns out that you can actually show that this entanglement is equal to the entropy of the reduced density matrix. So it's equal to the entropy that Bob or Alice sees. In fact, those two numbers you can show are equal. This provides a very simple way of calculating the amount of entanglement present in the system. What's more, we're going to show that this entanglement measure actually has some very nice properties, which lets you deduce some very nice things about this this measure. Very useful things, in fact. Okay, so that's how we calculate the entanglement present in psi. Actually, a nice fact, of course, is that a heck of a lot is known about these entropies, so we can use that fact to study entanglement transformations. But also, the converse point of view is that, well, we've now got a new interpretation for this entropy, which we can use to obtain prove new facts about the entropy. So it kind of goes both ways. A very nice fact that. Okay, let me just give you a little example of this definition in action. Imagine that I had this state here. So, well, I've got a parameter theta now in the problem. The case where theta is pi on 4, of course, corresponds to the maximally entangled state. If we go through and actually just calculate the entanglement in this state psi, I've plotted it from 0, which corresponds to the product state 0, 0, where you've got 0 entanglement, all the way over to pi on 2, where now you've just got the product state 1, 1, so you get again get zero entanglement. And in between, you go through a maximum, which corresponds to that Bell state. And it's not difficult to show that, in fact, two spin 1/2 particles or two qubits can't have more than one e-bit of shared entanglement. So people often, yeah, they like units, so they talk about the number of e-bits of entanglement in a particular state. I should mention, by the way, that in my entropy, which I define for the logarithm in the entropy is taken to base 2. We're going to measure everything in bits rather than the natural logarithm. Just a minor point. Otherwise, this maximum here wouldn't be at 1. It'd be at the log of 2, whatever that was. Okay. The next point I'd like to make is just a very simple one about the properties of this entanglement measure, and that is that it can only decrease under local operations and classical communication. We kind of took that as our definition before, but now we're going to prove it for sort of consistency, that you can't increase the amount of entanglement if Alice and Bob do local operations and classical communication. The proof is trivial. Imagine that you've got a state psi, which you can convert to a state phi by local operations and classical communication. Our task is to prove that the amount of entanglement in psi is at least as big as the amount of entanglement in phi. The proof is just a couple of lines. Imagine that we had n copies of psi. Well, of course we'd be able to convert it into n copies of phi. And now we can convert our n copies of phi into n times e of phi Bell states by definition of the entanglement present in phi. But that means that we can convert n copies of psi into n times e of phi Bell states by local operations and classical communication, just by concatenating the two protocols. But remember that by local operations and classical communication, the most Bell states that we could obtain out of a copy of psi was the entanglement of psi. And what that means then is that the entanglement of psi must be at least as big as the entanglement present in phi. Okay. So that's a very important fact, which turns out to be extremely useful for analysing problems. I'm going to give you an example where you can use it to analyse a problem in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to show how you can analyse teleportation, in fact, or analyse approximate teleportation. Before I do that, I want to mention just a couple of open problems related to measures of entanglement. The first problem is the procedure for converting one type of entanglement to another reversible in general? The procedure I've described was just for pure quantum states, and it turns out that there it is always reversible. Now, what has been discovered, in fact, has only just been rigorously proved in really the last few months, but has been suspected for a few years, is that when you allow mixed states into the mix, or into the game, it's not necessarily always possible to do a reversible conversion. And this is bad news. Why is it bad news? Well, remember that picture I had earlier where we were talking about labels on quantum states or labels on physical systems? We wanted some sort of an equivalence relation. We wanted to be able to go backwards and forwards between our different types of states in order for those labels to make sense. Well, if you've got, for example, a meter ruler, you can divide it up into 100 1-centimeter lengths. And then you can take those 1-centimeter lengths and, in principle, put them together back together into a meter ruler. It turns out that with entanglement, that is not necessarily always the case. In particular, something called bound entanglement has been discovered. So this is a property whereby, in order to form a number of copies of the bound entangled state, say n copies of it, it requires a certain number of Bell states. But it turns out that if you want to convert your copies of the bound entangled state back into the copies of the Bell entanglement, it's actually not possible. It's not possible even if I only require that I get one copy of this Bell state back. So entanglement conversion is in some sense not reversible, or so it appears there, at least for mixed states. So that seems to me to be a very serious problem for people trying to develop measures of mixed state entanglement. And there's a lot of ongoing work aimed at understanding bound entanglement better. I've got a proposal, I guess, for maybe fixing the problem and making the the conversion always reversible. To explain it, I need to do a little bit of background first. You know, I allowed Alice and Bob to talk classically in doing their conversions. But you might, you know, what's special about classical information? Imagine that I took that ability away from them. Well, that would even more severely restrict their abilities. In fact, you can show that even with pure states, it's not possible to do reversible conversion when they're so restricted. But might it be possible to, in fact, enlarge the class of communication they can do in order to get some sort of reversible conversion going on, allow them something more than just a classical communications channel? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it suggests a large number of interesting open problems. In particular, it would be very nice to be able to divide the class of communications channels up into different sort of equivalence classes. So two channels would be said to be equivalent, two communications channels would be said to be equivalent then, if they enabled the same class of reversible entanglement transformations. And at the moment we know of a few different classes. One is the constant channel, so Alice, whenever she sends information to Bob, Bob just gets a standard state out. That doesn't allow them to convey any information. That's the case of sort of no channel at all, so to speak. Then there's classical channels. There's channels producing so-called distillable entanglement, that is channels out of which you can actually obtain some Bell states. And then there are channels, communication channels, which are capable of producing bound entangled states. So each of these different classes of channels, potentially at least, would allow a different class of reversible entanglement transformations. And what I'm hoping is that by allowing sort of a rich enough class of channels, maybe a little bit richer than just allowing classical communication, it might be possible to always get reversible interconversion of one entangled state to another. It's just a bit of speculation at the moment. Okay, let me go back to kind of what's already known and illustrate an application of this technique for quantifying entanglement. In particular, I want to talk about approximate teleportation. So recall that in the original teleportation protocol, you started out with a perfect maximally entangled state. Of course, in reality, you're not going to have a perfect maximally entangled state. There'll be a little bit of noise in it. How good or how well can we teleport in such an instance? Now, that's a very difficult problem because, of course, there's an enormous number of things which Alice and Bob could potentially do. I'm going to allow them a very general class of teleportation protocols. In fact, I'm going to allow them the ability to do anything. Alice can do anything at all that she likes on her system. They can do arbitrary back and forth classical communication, and Bob can do arbitrary local operations on his system. So, you know, how well can they do? And that would be a very difficult problem to analyze from scratch. Fortunately, with the tools that, or this measure of entanglement, it actually turns out to be almost trivial to analyze the problem. Let me explain that, how it works. Let me just first of all remind you of how the original teleportation protocol works. We've got our measuring device, does a measurement, send the information off to Bob, and then conditional on that measurement result, Bob is able to recover the original state. I want to propose a slight variant of the original protocol that will let me analyze approximate teleportation. What the variant involves is, instead of having this single particle here, you replace it with two particles which are in a maximally entangled state. So just to indicate who's entangled with who, these two particles are entangled, these two particles are entangled, and Alice and Bob are just going to do the teleportation protocol on these three particles as before. So they go away, they do their measurement as before, get their result. Of course, doing that measurement destroys the entanglement in the system. Send the measurement off to Bob, who then is able to recover the state. And I hope you'll agree that, well, it's at least intuitively plausible that the entanglement that these two particles initially shared has now become entanglement shared between these two particles. The basic reason for this is that if you're able to teleport every possible state of this system, then in fact it turns out that you can teleport the entanglement as well. And that's pretty easy to show. So The ability to teleport an arbitrary state implies the ability to teleport entanglement. And you just have to take my word for that. Okay, well, this picture lets us analyze approximate teleportation. Imagine that instead of having a perfectly entangled state, Alice and Bob share E bits of entanglement, where E is less than one, it's less than maximal entanglement. But again, they're going to try and teleport this maximally entangled state, or this half of a maximally entangled state, over to Bob. Well, let's think about how much entanglement is present in the system. Initially, well, there's E bits between Alice and Bob, and all of this entanglement is internal to Alice's system, so it doesn't contribute to the entanglement between Alice and Bob, so the total entanglement is at most E bits. If Alice and Bob do a teleportation protocol only involving local operations on their respective systems and classical communication, then the final entanglement can't be any more than when it started. It can't be more than EE bits. So at the end of the day, well, the total entanglement between Alice and Bob's system is at most E bits. So the entanglement between just part of Alice's system and Bob's system is certainly no larger. You can show that easily. It's never more than EE bits. But remember that at the start of the right at the beginning of the day, the amount of entanglement between this qubit and this qubit was 1 e-bit, and at the end of the day, the entanglement between this qubit and this qubit is at most e bits, so it's decreased. What that means is that some of the states must have been imperfectly teleported. Remember before we agreed that, you know, if you could do perfect teleportation, then, or if they were always perfectly teleported, then the entanglement would be teleported too. And in fact, it's very easy using the tools of quantum information to make this quantitative. What you can show, well, let me just explain a little bit of notation first. The idea, well, let me just go back to the original protocol, make a definition. When you've got this imperfect entanglement in a starting state psi, and you run the teleportation protocol and end up with some imperfect copy of psi, which we'll call rho, a good measure, or a pretty good measure, for how well the teleportation protocol has succeeded is just the overlap between the final state and the initial state. And a way of characterizing globally the teleportation protocol is to minimize this overlap. So if the teleportation protocol were perfect, you'd end up, this minimum overlap would of course be the value 1, because rho would always just be the state psi. But when it's not perfect, it's less than 1, and the worse it is, the closer it gets down to the minimum possible value of 0. Okay, so this is sort of a way of characterizing how well you've done at your teleportation. What you can show, it's just basically a calculation using those ideas before, is that in fact this minimum fidelity is less than or equal to 1 minus 1 third, 1 minus the initial entanglement which they shared. What does this mean? Well, let's think about what 1 minus E is. 1 minus E is basically how far away, it's a measure of how far away they were from being maximally entangled initially. So if they were maximally entangled, this would be 0, and this wouldn't tell you anything at all. It would just tell you that the minimum fidelity was less than or equal to 1, which we already know. It certainly can't be more than 1 to start with, because overlaps can never be more than 1. And that's what we expect, because we know we can do perfect teleportation in that case. But as this entanglement gets smaller and smaller, in particular as it goes off to 0 e-bits, this gets closer and closer to 1, and f-min becomes less than or equal to 2 thirds in that case. It's telling you that you're actually going to do pretty badly as you decrease the total amount of entanglement which they initially share. So this, you know, is a very sort of nice quantitative means for analysing what happens when you've got imperfect entanglement at the start of the teleportation protocol, and allows you to analyse a very general class of teleportation protocols. It's a very complicated problem which you can analyse using these ideas. So let's abstract away a few lessons from this discussion of entanglement measures. It's sort of a general approach to doing information science, either quantum or classical. These three sort of axioms, or this approach, I guess, is something which Ben Schumacher outlined to me earlier this year. In this approach, what you first of all do is you start off by identifying some kind of a physical resource. Maybe it's entanglement, maybe it's energy, maybe it's bits, maybe it's time, maybe it's space, whatever. some sort of goal. You want to teleport a qubit. Maybe you want to compress the information being produced by an information source. Maybe you want to transmit some information over a noisy channel. And you have some criteria for success. So in the example of our teleportation protocol, it was this fidelity criteria, and we wanted that fidelity to be close to one. And then one way of stating what at least most papers in information science seem to be about is, it says, how much of one do I need to achieve two while satisfying three? And actually, if you look at papers on quantum information science at the moment, a really quite a remarkable fraction of them basically boil down to this. In fact, even things like, even very complicated things, like for example, Peter Shor's famous paper on factoring is in a sense just an example of this, although in that particular case, he's got a very complicated goal. Quantum, you know, basically we've got a much simpler goal. And I think that in order to sort of make progress and develop a global, good global picture, it's good to start with simple goals. So that's the sort of goal that I've started with today. You'll notice that I've actually gone through this procedure twice today. Both examples I've analyzed in exactly this way. So in the first one, the physical resource was copies of a particular state, psi. The goal was to transform it reversibly into copies of a Bell state. And the criteria for success was just that you had to be able to do it sort of perfectly or asymptotically perfectly. The second example was our physical resource was this initial imperfectly entangled state. The goal was to do teleportation, and the criteria for success was just this fidelity measure. So we've gone through the same process both times. Okay. Let me just give you a little brief summary. In quantum information science, as abstracted in those principles, offers a general approach to the identification and quantification of novel physical resources in quantum mechanics. Actually, I could also cross off novel there, even sort of well-known physical resources, basically by following that program through. By identifying such physical resources, we can simplify the description of phenomena in complex quantum systems. An interesting thing happened there. You'll notice we started out by asking a very simple question about reversible conversion of one state to another. We got a good answer, the entropy, or the amount of entanglement present in the state, and then we were able to use that to analyze a much more complicated phenomenon. So by asking simple questions first, we can later gain insight into much more complicated phenomena. There's a whole bunch of places, of course, where we can obtain such insight. The obvious ones are quantum communication, quantum computers, and maybe quantum optics. One I guess I'm particularly excited about at the moment is actually condensed matter systems. Something that I originally hoped to maybe talk about today is some work I've been doing with Tobias Osborne, where we've applied ideas about entanglement to gain some insight into the density matrix renormalization group. Which was developed in the early 1990s by Steve White, and I think we've actually gained quite some considerable insight into the density matrix renormalization group, and maybe there's some hope for obtaining more general insights into condensed matter physics using some of these ideas of quantum information science. Excuse me. So that's basically my talk today. I'm just going to give you a little coda. So I've outlined one approach to quantum information science. I'm just going to take a couple of minutes, and I'm going to do something completely different. It's not directly related to this. Carl, is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, good. Just I make that clock actually 2 minutes fast by my watch, but anyway, I don't like to be kept after time, so I don't want to do it to other people. You know, I've outlined one approach to quantum information science. Well, I want to throw that away and say, I want you to imagine a completely different sort of motivation for doing quantum information science. This completely different motivation, I mean, why do that? Well, basically, I guess my opinion is that one way of trying to do science is to try and identify very clear motivations for pursuing a particular line of attack. And I think that program is a pretty clear program to follow. But there are many other ways as well, and there are other ways which people in quantum information science are pursuing. And I think those are interesting as well. So I just want to give you the flavor of one such way. And that's to take sort of fundamental questions from classical information science and ask whether or not they might have any implications quantum mechanically. And I'm just going to give you a very simple example. The problem which it's related to in quantum mechanics is what can we measure in quantum mechanics? So just remember that if you want to describe a quantum measurement, it's described, according to all the textbooks, by some observable M. That is a Hermitian operator acting on the state space of the system. And if you measure a system prepared in an eigenstate of M, then the result of your measurement will be the corresponding eigenvalue of M. And this is just basic quantum mechanics. Now, you might ask, is it possible to measure every possible, every observable, every Hermitian operator that you can imagine? This is an important question. After all, one of the lessons of quantum mechanics is that we've got to be careful about what we say we can measure. And in order to really regard the theory as complete, I think, you need to actually be able to say what is possible to measure in principle. And Dirac gave an answer to this question in his famous text. He said that, yes, any observable at all should be measurable. I think there's a slightly more refined view now. There's some results due to Wigner, Rocky, and Yanais that show that, in fact, you have to back off a little bit from Dirac's point of view, that conservation principles actually imply some constraints. But I want to talk about a very different class of constraints today, which is actually motivated by some observations from computer science. So let me explain those observations from computer science. I'm going to talk about the halting problem. And I first of all need to explain how you can always describe a computer program. Imagine you've got a universal computer, a Turing machine, a Wintel laptop, it doesn't matter. You can always, without loss of generality, describe the input to that machine in two parts. One is just some sort of input string, like this, I like quantum information science, and then a program that does something on that input. And you can encode, there's sort of an equivalent description, which is much simpler than all these, all this indentation and whatnot. You can look at, for example, first of all, the ASCII representation of the input. So I've just translated this input into ASCII. I've translated the program into an ASCII string. And then you can further simplify the description by encoding the ASCII string just as a single number. And there are lots and lots of ways of doing that. One way is just to encode an ASCII string in the prime factorization of a number, with the exponents being the different ASCII values. And that provides a unique way of encoding the input and the program. So any program and input for a universal computer can be uniquely encoded as a pair of positive integers. Okay, let me talk a little bit about one of the great results of computer science, the so-called halting problem. The halting problem is, well, I don't know why they call it the halting problem, it's really the stopping problem, because people say that their computer's stopped, not that it's halted. But anyway, does program number X halt on input of number X? That's the halting problem as defined by Turing and Church and a whole bunch of other people. So in other words, does my computer stop when I input the number X to program X? And you can define a function that sort of encapsulates this, the so-called halting function. It's defined to be 0 if program number X halts on input of X and 1 otherwise. And what Church and Turing asked, actually motivated by a question of David Hilbert, is whether there's an algorithm to solve for the halting problem, that is, to compute the halting function. And what they showed is that, in fact, no such algorithm is possible. The proof is almost a one-liner. It's proof by contradiction. They say, suppose such an algorithm exists, then they can use that algorithm to define another program, which we'll call Turing of X. And what this other program does is, if its input, H of its input is equal to 1, then it halts, and otherwise it just keeps going forever. Because we've assumed that an algorithm to compute the halting function exists, this is a legitimate program. Obviously we need some sort of subroutine to compute this value here. Now, because it's a legitimate program, it's got some program number. Let T be its program number. Now, let's consider this event, that Turing of T halts, Turing halts on input of T. Well, by definition of the halting function, that's equivalent to H of T being 0. But if we look at the program, when does it halt? Well, it halts exactly when H of T is equal to 1. So we've got two equivalences here. We see that h of t is equal to 0 if and only if it's equal to 1. This is obviously a contradiction. And we conclude that our initial assumption must be false. No such algorithm could possibly exist for our computer. Okay. Well, let's translate this into sort of quantum mechanical terms. We're going to talk about the halting observable. We're going to have a system, say a harmonic oscillator, whose basis states correspond, you can number them 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Define the halting observable so that its eigenstates are those number states, and the corresponding eigenvalues are just the value for the halting function. And now, if you were able, well, there are two possibilities. You ask the question, can we build a measuring device capable of measuring the halting observable? We can ask, there are two answers to this question. Yes. If so, then that would give us a procedure for solving the halting problem, because we could prepare, you know, the appropriate eigenstate and just read off using our measuring device the value of the halting observable, the halting function. And no, in which case there's some interesting class of superselection rules which control what observables may in fact be measured. I'm not going to try and resolve this issue. I just want to indicate to you that basically by taking ideas from computer science and translating them into quantum mechanical terms, you can come up with some very interesting questions. And that concludes my talk.
Building.
I guess.
I mean, one way of building is I imagine someone who I give him a Hermitian operator and he adds it to the kind of formula. More coefficient.
Yep.
Thereby constructing a measuring device.
Yep.
That is a lab procedure.
Let me make a couple of comments. Actually, the first one is that, of course, you can translate this into a sort of a dynamical equivalent, which is what you've done. But it just begs the question then, what's the allowed class of dynamics? So you've taken it one step further back, which is a very interesting thing to do, but it wouldn't resolve sort of the fundamental dichotomy. Yeah.
Was it based on exactly that?
Yeah.
Any Hermitian operator could be regarded as a non-Hermitian cost perturbation theory.
Yep. So I basically think that it doesn't matter really how you. There's an interesting problem in there somewhere, no matter how you choose to phrase it. And you can push it back into the Hamiltonian dynamics if you wish. In fact, of course, you'd expect to be able to do so. We expect that you can explain measurement using just Hamiltonian dynamics. But there's still a good question in there somewhere, some sort of complexity theory for dynamics.
In the beginning of your talk, you stressed the importance of having the concept of entanglement be independent of representation.
Yep.
If I take a state with two qubits and I define some multi-qubit state, two quads or something, that are, you know, linear combinations, some four-dimensional matrix that transforms them, I can produce a state that, in that new basis, is not entangled. How do you...
I guess I'd need a more concrete sort of...
Well, you just have that Bell state.
Yep.
So I just define that to be projected onto this state of, you know, 0, 0 in this new basis, and I don't worry about what the other three linearly independent states are doing. It's just where I don't care about which is particle one, which is particle two. Then I can... It's just a four-dimensional matrix, I think.
Okay, if I am understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that you can always interpret it as being just a single physical system with a four-dimensional state space. That's certainly true. No doubt about that. What I'm saying is, assume that you've got some tensor product structure already present. Can you use this then to obtain some interesting information? You'll notice that when I analyzed the approximate teleportation, I had to restrict myself in terms of what class of operations I could do in order to get interesting information. That restriction, exactly. You've got the tensor product structure as kind of implicit in what operations I'm doing. It's a little bit like, actually, I'll give you an example. Are you familiar with Maxwell's demon at all? So yeah, Maxwell proposed this famous. He proposed this demon, 160 odd years ago, which appeared to be capable of violating the second law of thermodynamics. And of course, this paradox was eventually resolved. But basically, the problem was that what Maxwell had done was introduce a new type of physical system into the game that wasn't allowed according to the rules of thermodynamics as they were currently understood. It wasn't described by the laws of thermodynamics and at that time, or at least there was no easy description. And what was done in the 70s and 80s, in fact, by some of the people in this room, was to show that if you gave the correct thermodynamic description of those entities, in particular the demon, then you'd be able to account for this supposed paradox. So what they did was they sort of extended the class of physical processes that we knew how to describe using the laws of thermodynamics. Now, the analogy here is that, in terms of understanding entanglement or developing a theory of entanglement, there's some class of physical processes which we're able to study by using this theory of entanglement. In particular, we can get a lot of insight into processes involving only local operations and classical communications. But if you sort of enlarge the class of processes, then maybe you won't get so, well, it's harder to get interesting information out. Okay, maybe we should talk about it later. All right. Yep.
How much of what you said is depends on just having a house involved and not multiple product
and house bar? I think the answer is that at a technical level, quite a lot. In terms of sort of aims and goals, not a whole heck of a lot. Multi-party entanglement, even in the three system case, is certainly not as well understood as two party. Although there's an incredible amount of work.
So none of this then automatically beyond
two-party. To be more specific, what you mean by technical level and aims and goals?
I think people want to get to the same point in terms of having well-defined measures and being able to say when two states are equivalent under local operations and classical communication, and I guess for some sort of restricted multi-party cases, they do know the answer to those questions, but certainly for the K-party entanglement, they're not even close. In fact, even in the two-party mixed state case, they don't completely understand yet. A lot of progress has been made. Definitely the second. Yeah. Yeah.
I was struck by the discussion you gave of the approximate teleportation.
Yep.
Where I hadn't thought about it correctly before. So the point here was that, or at least one of the conclusions that you gave along the way was. Alice teleported one member of what was another.
Yep.
And then that entanglement got transported in some sense.
Yep.
So I can kind of turn that on its head a little bit when you think about Alice is transporting a mixed state rather than a pure state.
Yep.
She doesn't know that there's this third particle around as far as she's concerned. Maybe she hadn't. Her atom decayed slightly.
Yep, yep.
And so
into a reservoir.
And so Bob then gets the mixed state on his side. Does that mean that if I were to detect the photon that was, decayed from the atom, that Bob's state would then become pure state? It's the same, that is to say, there's all of that information that is contained within the system.
Actually, let me make a couple of points. One, yes, absolutely, I agree 100%. That is indeed what would happen if Bob that extra particle was just a emission into the electromagnetic field modes. and you, you know, detected the emitted photon, yes, indeed, you would get a pure conditional state, and so on and so forth. What you've reminded me of is actually something that I neglected to say in the talk, and maybe would make matters a little bit clearer. That extra system that I introduced into the analysis of the problem was done as a theoretical convenience. It was introduced as kind of an intermediate that would allow us to do some analysis and obtain a result that just applied to the original sort of the original system. I didn't make that point sufficiently clear. And this seems like a good opportunity to correct that point.
Okay. No other questions? Let's thank Michael.